morning and welcome to WNHH Radio's High Haven program about everything Jewish in your community. I'm your host, Paul Bass, and Rabbi John J. Tilson of Congregation Beth El Kesser Israel is joining us here in the studio today. Rabbi Tilson is back from another trip to rural North Dakota. Last time he came here to talk us about protests against a pipeline going through tribal lands. This time, Rabbi John J. is back from a trip where he took part in the rededication of a Jewish cemetery in a place where living Jews are nowhere to be found anymore, but where one of the country's largest population of Jewish homesteaders once arrived seeking to make a better life in a new country, a story that is common to many parts of the country, not just North Dakota. We even know that story here in New Haven. Rabbi John J. has returned with an inspiring story that's applicable to our own community, and he's here to tell us about that. Welcome back to the WNHH studio, John J.
Thank you, Paul. I'm glad to be here.
Now, tell us why you were traveling to the Beth Itzchak, otherwise known as Ashley Jewish Homesteader Cemetery in McIntosh County, North Dakota.
Well, this was my third visit, lifetime visit, to the cemetery. I'm on the board of directors of this cemetery. It's a small cemetery with about 30 burials. But of those 30, three of them are family members.
Including, wow, you're full 10%.
Well, that's it. My great-grandmother and one of her sons and then a cousin on my mother's side are buried there.
Both sides of your family.
As it turns out.
So this is in rural North Dakota. Where in North Dakota?
It's in central southern North Dakota, McIntosh County. It's just a few miles north of the border from South Dakota.
So there's a cemetery there that you're on the board of. Three of your relatives from the early 1900s are buried in. Why were you there? When were you there? 2 weeks ago? 3 weeks ago?
It was, just before Shavuot.
Mm-hmm.
The cemetery in the past few years underwent a bit of a restoration of the tombstones. Some wonderful volunteers fixed them up. And through the work of a wonderful school teacher and really terrific historian, Rebecca Bender, and some people helping her, the cemetery got enrolled in the list of the National Registry of Historic Places.
Now, is this teacher from North Dakota?
Well, she's actually originally from South Dakota, but just across the border.
So she's a local.
Yeah, I think the family mostly lives in Minnesota now, but I think some family members are in South Dakota.
So about 30 people are buried there. When was the last person buried in this cemetery?
Oh, it would have to be maybe the 1940s.
So you've been involved in a cemetery with just 30 graves in rural North Dakota where no one has been buried for close to 80 years. What got you? You said you had three relatives there. Why would people like you and the school teacher be concerned about the status of that cemetery?
Yeah, I think, we're born into a world as is, and we kind of assume things have always been the way they are. But one question I think it's important to ask is, why am I here? And not just an existential question, but why did I grow up where I did in Minnesota? Or why do I live in Connecticut? Or how did I come to America? So it's part of this is all part of my story, and it's the story of my family. And
to know who we are, we need to know where we came from.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And it's a common story because probably millions of Jews of Ashkenazic ancestry have very similar stories.
Now, you're not the only one. A lot of people went to the cemetery right before Shavuot, beginning of June, I guess, for a rededication ceremony for this restored cemetery. How many people showed up?
There were 80 or 100 people from all over the country, from Washington and California and the Dakotas, of course.
So three times the population of the cemetery itself turned
indeed,
out.
Indeed.
They
even said, they even observed that there were people from what they call the East Coast, which means beyond Wisconsin.
It's so funny we think of it that way, because when you actually look at a map, that's not, it's halfway to the country, but we feel like it's all the way out west over here.
Indeed it is. It's quite close to the Continental Divide.
So how do you get to this place? Do you fly to where?
Well, we flew to Fargo, North Dakota, just on the border with Minnesota, and stayed one night at Jamestown. It's about an hour and a half away. And then Ashley's another hour and a half.
And Ashley is in McIntosh County.
Indeed.
And that's the town where this is. What kind of town is Ashley?
Well, it's a small
synagogue, movie theaters.
Oh, no. No, there's a gas station. There's a grocery store. There's a few small businesses. Everything is closed on Sunday except for the grocery store. It's just a few hundred people in Ashley, as it was 100 years ago. They're all friendly, but it's a small town. Our event was kind of the big event in town that weekend, that plus two graduation parties. And two graduation party means maybe they had one high school graduate that year and maybe the other was college.
Can you get the internet there?
Well, you can get it on your phone anywhere. Yeah.
Okay. So you had this big event, and I take it there haven't been any Jews living there for a long time.
It's
fair
been a long
to say
time.
75, 80 years, no Jews living there.
Well, people remembered. I heard this when I visited with my father, like 40 years ago, people remembered Dr. Cohen. He was the dentist. He was the last Jew. And when we went there last month, they said the same thing. Yes, you know, they still remember Dr. Cohen.
How long ago was Dr. Cohen there?
Well, more than 40 years.
More than 40 years ago, he's been gone.
I think so.
But they still remember Dr. Cohen, the dentist.
Yeah.
Must have been a good dentist or else not a good dentist.
he was remembered fondly.
So you were there around with 80 to 100 people from around the country coming to this restored cemetery in North Dakota. What brought everybody together? What kind of reading? How did it come about that they were restoring the cemetery?
It was the initiative of Rebecca Bender, Stuart Kaufman, some of the people who've been involved in maintaining and preserving the cemetery over the years.
So people who are maybe not as far away as some other people, is that fair, who had the relatives who had been buried there?
Well, they're kind of far away, too. I think Kaufman's in Washington or Oregon.
Wow.
So, but it's...
And was it since Jews left, was there still an interest in the cemetery, or was there a revival of interest? Had it gone into disuse?
Well, some decades ago, it was, say 30 years ago, it was basically a collection of grave sites, marked grave sites with a fence, a simple fence around it.
And was anyone keeping it up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s?
One of the local farmers was paid a few dollars a month to mow the lawn around it.
Where did the money come from?
Some time ago, some of the people who were interested, descendants of people in the cemetery, including my father, Bob Tilson, his brother, Ken, set up a bond or set up a small account that would pay out a few hundred dollars.
Did that happen because it had been neglected or no?
Well, it wasn't really neglected. It had been taken care of to some extent over the years. There came a point when the state of North Dakota offered to take over the cemetery, as they've done with hundreds of abandoned small cemeteries around the state.
We don't think about that often. Even New Haven, you go by some Potter's Field, some of that look like not cared for cemeteries, because a lot of, I guess, fraternal organizations or other congregations might have gone out of business, and you kind of no one's taking care of the land.
Yeah. Well, happily, North Dakota decided they wanted to take care of all of the cemeteries in the state. So
there's been this interest. What happened at this ceremony? Like what had been done for rededication? There'd been new work done on it. What was the impetus for this event?
A couple of monuments were set up, stones with inscriptions that told a little bit about the history of the cemetery and about the homesteaders, mostly farmers who came to the area. So in the ceremony, we heard a little bit of memoirs from people who lived in the era, a little bit of music, and a few...
People played live music?
Yeah, it was a little hard because it was windy, but we had live music.
And then you said people from the town who are not Jewish also came to this event, even though there was competition with graduation parties.
They did. They were interested, and they were so nice.
They were nice. They were happy that this thing was there.
I think so.
All right. Well, we're talking about the graves of our fathers and mothers and how we restore them, how we find them, and what it tells us about our lives today. You're listening to High Haven on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio, broadcast at 103.5 FM and live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Rabbi John J. Tilson of Congregation Beth El Kisser Israel in Westville is here telling us about a trip he made earlier this month to rural North Dakota for the rededication of a small cemetery, 30-some-odd graves, of Jews in North Dakota who were homesteaders in the early 1900s. So tell us about that, John Jay. When, how did Jews come, including your relatives, to this pocket of North Dakota, and how long were they there?
Yeah, my great-grandparents, Yehuda Leib Rabin and Miral Chaplik, were really quite typical. Yehuda Leib came to America, to Philadelphia, in 1905. He worked for about a year and a half to save money.
Why did he come to Philadelphia? From where?
Why Philadelphia? He had a relative there.
Where did he come
from? They came
from
a really small town, a rural area in what is today Transnistria, kind of Moldova, let's
Translistria?
Say. Transnistria? Transnistria.
Sounds like a mouthwash.
It's a small area between Moldova and Ukraine near Tiraspol, but a small town.
Again, now, that's from the 1880s on, there was this historic migration of Jews from Eastern Europe, fleeing pogroms or army service or looking for a better life. Was that the situation with your folks?
Yes, indeed it was. I mean, part of the ideology, there was a revivalist movement in European Jewry to return to the land, to give up the city life and become farmers. Well, of course, my great-grandparents were already living in a very small town in a rural area. I think he was like a grain merchant. But the problem there was, in addition to the insecurity, Jews were not allowed to own land. They could not be farmers.
In Eastern Europe?
In the Russian Empire, in most of the Russian Empire for most of the time. So it was insecure, and indeed, after my great-grandfather left, just a couple months later, was one of the more well-known pogroms in Odessa, in which one of his wife's cousins was killed. And that's the nearest large
city. So his name was Yehuda Leib?
Yehuda Leib, or in America, Lewis.
Lewis, L-E-W-I-S or L-O-U-I-S?
L-O-U-I-S, usually.
So he came to Philadelphia where he had a relative.
He worked for a year and a half, saved money. He opened a special bank account where he could make weekly or monthly deposits, specifically dedicated to pay boat passage for his wife, and then they had six children. Two more were born in North Dakota. So about a year and a half later, wife and six children come. They work in...
But I thought four hadn't been born yet.
Sorry. Six were born and came over, and two more were born in...
Wow,
so
that's
a big
brood.
Total of eight. It was fairly typical. They worked in Philadelphia for about 6 months, and then they moved out to North Dakota. They got 80 acres free from the government, and then they bought another 80 acres.
Oh, we're talking 1907?
This would be 1906, 1907.
And was there a homesteading program? Was the government, you said there was a back-to-land movement among Jews. Was there also a federal program that encouraged people to settle out west?
Yes, the Homesteading Act had been open for quite some years already, and by the time my family got there, most of the better land was actually taken already, but there was land available. You just had to work it a little harder. My great-grandfather's brother, couple, also tried to farm just a few miles south in South Dakota, just across the border.
So why did they go? I got why they came to Philly. Why did he want to go to North Dakota for the land?
He had a dream of being a farmer.
So he thought he could have a family that would prosper by farming the land in North Dakota.
That was the idea.
So he came 1906, 1907, Yehuda Leib, his wife, six kids, soon to be eight kids. Were they the first people from your family to settle there?
The first in North Dakota, yeah.
And was that McIntosh County?
Yes.
All right. So what happened?
Well, farming was kind of hard. The land is not as productive as, say, Iowa or even Minnesota farmland. It was rocky where they were. They worked hard. In 1913, my great-grandmother, Miral Chaplik, was killed in a runaway horse and buggy accident.
How do you say Miral Chaplik? How do you spell that?
Well, Miral is Miriam, M-I-R-E-L, Miral Chaplik, however you want, C-H-A-P-L-I-K. We have cousins in Chicago and Israel and other places by that name as well.
So she was there with
the family. She was killed in this accident, so leaving now her husband and eight children.
Wow.
He farmed.
Boy, that's tough.
It was tough. It turned out they were not so successful. They had, besides just the hardship of starting a new farm with nothing and without experience as a farmer.
What were they trying to grow?
They also faced, they ended up, well, he was mostly wheat, although they also had a vegetable garden, which they enjoyed tremendously, but it was basically wheat.
How do you know this?
Family history. Some of the neighbors wrote about them.
Really? And was it a nice community? Was there anti-Semitism? Did they face any kind of challenges there?
Mostly people were okay. There were some of the others in settlers and homesteaders in North Dakota who had a vision for a society where people of various backgrounds could come and live together peacefully. So that was kind of a nice thing. There were, of course, others who, not so much. So they faced...
So were there a lot of was there a Jewish community there?
Yeah, indeed. So cemetery, eventually a synagogue. They used to get together for the holidays in nearby towns, Lair or Ashley.
Was there a Jewish organization, you said, promoting this part of the country to Jewish homesteaders?
I don't know if...
Like, how did all the Jews end up in North Dakota?
Well, they learned about the... There were Jews who came from Texas who had learned about it from some of the Hebrew Immigration Society and similar organizations. I don't know how my family learned about this. They just knew that there was land available. Now, the thing about it is, kind of part of the background, is that while he wanted to be a farmer, couldn't buy land in Russia, also could not at that time buy land in Israel. Israel had been under occupation by the Ottoman, or controlled by the Ottoman Empire, for 300 years. And oddly, pretty much anyone in the world could purchase land in Ottoman Palestine except for Jews.
Had they wanted to go to Israel? Had they considered it?
Well, that would have been a natural option. The land is not, there was land there that's not worse than North Dakota, and it would be certainly Jewish, would offer them Jewish community of some sort, but not the security. They lacked security. They lacked the ability to buy land. Jews who did settle in Israel in that period mostly did it through the mechanisms of international or foreign colonies or corporations, which were allowed to buy land, but individuals.
But Syria had all these Jews in McIntosh County. How many?
Well, maybe 250 families. So it was the fourth largest Jewish homesteading farming community in the United States. Connecticut being one of the other big ones too.
Northeastern Connecticut.
Yeah, not so much in New Haven. But
we did a show about this a few weeks ago. How they later became the summer retreats.
Yeah, well, there's still some farmers up there.
Yeah. So they were homesteading. It didn't go well. How long did the Jewish community last there?
Well, so my grandfather's, great-grandfather's farm lasted until about 1920. No, there was the Dust Bowl also. Just they had a few bad years, which just killed them. Meanwhile, my grandfather, so my grandmother is a farmer's daughter, right? So my grandmother is one of the children of this family.
Of Yehuda Leib's side. Is that your mother's father's side or your mother's side?
My father's mother. So my grandmother, Esther, she's a farmer's daughter. My grandfather, who has a different story, they came by way of Milwaukee, also from near Kiev. He was a traveling salesman.
Is that the other side of your family, your mother's
side? This is my dad's father.
Oh, still your father's side.
Yeah. So I'm talking about my dad's mother, farmer's daughter. My dad's father was a traveling salesman. They met, got married. One of his brothers married her sister. One of his sisters married her brother. So we have a lot of Robins and Tilsons, or today they use the name Reuben. It migrated a bit. They also, so even after Yehuda Leib left in maybe 1922, went back to Philadelphia to live with cousins. He met up with his brother, who also came back to Philadelphia.
And how many of his family members were buried in this cemetery, Beth Yitzchak?
Well, his wife and one of their children died in the flu epidemic in 1918.
So the wife's name was?
Muriel Chaplin.
Muriel, and the child?
Son was Benjamin, or Benjamin Dove.
So they're buried there.
They're buried
there.
He goes
back to Philly.
But the children stayed there. They're adult children. My grandmother's now married, and sister's married, and they're all married, so... some of them stayed for a while.
How long?
Well, in the case of my grandparents, Ed and Esther Tilson, till about 1930. My grandfather started a store. He had numerous businesses, one of them being a dry goods store in western North Dakota, way out by Montana, a small town called New Leipzig. He ran a store there for about 5 years until 1930. Everybody lost their businesses. He was one of them. And he left to seek new opportunities.
So they all left, but two were left behind in Barrie. But meanwhile, another side of your father's side of the family came down from Milwaukee.
My dad's father had come, and two of his brothers, and a couple of their sisters.
And how did they came from Milwaukee? Same kind of homesteading deal. Did they know the Yehuda Leib's family?
Well, they met him. There weren't that many Jewish people to be found, so they had
their own farm.
Well, my grandfather wasn't a farmer. He was trying to start a business. Same for his two of his brothers. One of the brothers stayed until his death in the 1950s. He was in Bismarck.
Okay, Bismarck. But they must have met and married somehow, right? Isn't that how it became your father's side of the family?
Yeah, my grandmother told the story that Ed was, they had a dance, like a barn dance one night, and my grandfather was there, and he was dancing with all the girls, and my grandmother fell in love with him.
Wow. Sounds like quite a dance.
Yeah.
And this is quite a walk down memory lane with a lesson for today with Rabbi John J. Tilson on WNHH Radio's High Haven program about everything Jewish in our community. WNHH FM is your home for everything about the New Haven community at 103.5 and live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We're talking about a trip Rabbi John J. Tilson of Congregation Beth El Kesser Israel in Westville made this month to rural North Dakota, where three of his relatives were buried, back from a time when Jewish homesteaders had a community in North Dakota that long has left, but the cemetery remains. It's been restored, and recently 80 to 100 descendants of the people buried there gathered. Now, John J., you have someone from your mother's side of the family is also buried there. Who is that?
It's a Goldstein or Goldstone relative. It was a child who died. I don't know died of an illness. I think it was 1922.
So how did that side of the family come down?
They were merchants. And in fact, this family lived also farther west. They lived in west of the Missouri River, which put them in Cannonball, North Dakota, which is on the reservation. 1920, for example, they show in the census, Cannonball is like 95% Native Americans, Indians, and 5% like Romanian Jews.
And why were you the tribes didn't mind people living there?
Apparently, I don't know.
And what was your family? What were the Goldstones doing there?
I believe they were just trying to operate a small business, like a dry good general store.
And then who, the child's name who died or how they died?
I think it was Isidore Yitzchak.
And then what, how old was he?
Maybe three.
And then his family there, did they meet your father's side of the family, Yehuda Leib's side of the family, while they were in North Dakota?
I don't know. You know,
but you know, it's an amazing coincidence. Here you are, this Connecticut, New Haven, Westville rabbi, and two sides of your family are buried in this small town in North Dakota where there have been no Jews for 80 years. And it would be quite a coincidence if they never met there, but they both became your parents' family.
Yeah, well, you know, the Jews tended to find each other, at least for the holidays or events. So in all likelihood, they came across each other.
But where did your mother and father meet?
My parents met in Minneapolis. So my mom's family mostly was in Minneapolis. And after the 1930s, by about 1935, my dad and his family were in St. Paul.
Mm-hmm. So, had your dad ever lived in North Dakota?
Yeah, he was born in a hospital in Bismarck and grew up in New Leipzig, a really small town. It's just a couple hundred people today. And
how far is it from the cemetery?
Well, it's a good couple hour drive.
Oh, okay.
It's far.
But they went to Minneapolis, St. Paul. Your mother's family went there. Did your mother also get born in North Dakota?
My mother is born in Minneapolis.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. They met there, and it turns out they both had roots in that same area with the cemetery. So when did you first become aware of this cemetery, Johnji?
Well, when I think after high school, my dad took me for a trip out to visit, kind of a family roots
and
trip.
And why was he? Oh, so was he interested? Had he kept all these years up at the cemetery?
Yes. My dad was interested, and he still is. So my dad was with us on this recent trip. He was born in Bismarck in 1925, and my dad, along with one of my brothers, one of my sisters, and our daughter Tova, were all on this most recent trip. So he went out there. You know, part of the reason the background for wanting to preserve the cemetery. I mean, you would for anyone, and it's an important way to honor our history and ancestors. But the memory from my dad's side, what happened to the cemetery where his dad grew up near a village, Shtetl, Vinograd, near Zvenigorodka in the southern Kiev district, where my grandfather also left in 1906 with his older brother, younger sister, and parents. My grandfather's older siblings had left just 4 or 5 years before. But what happened to their cemetery after, well, what happened to the people, the ones who survived the pogroms and survived the pogroms after World War One, and who stayed, most of them ended up at Babi Yar. Most of them were massacred during World War II. And even the cemetery was plowed under completely. All the stones were removed and the field was plowed over. It's just farmland. It's just like any other farmland. So not only were all the people removed, but any physical trace of this Jewish community that had lived there probably for 200 years, utterly gone. And we didn't want that to happen.
And they think that's why your father was taking you down to North Dakota?
That's part of the backstory.
What do you remember from that trip? Did you go to the cemetery then?
Indeed, we did.
And what was it like as a just out of high school young man going to that cemetery? What did you feel? What do you remember from that trip? I'm assuming late 1970s.
Yeah, around. Yeah, it was
early 1980s.
North Dakota's beautiful, a lot of open land. The air is clean, but you drive and drive and like with farmland, and then like there's a tree in the distance, you know. I need to drive by the tree, and there's a house next to the tree, and then it's just vast. A lot of a pretty high proportion of the state is.
But a lot of people at that age, they don't connect so much when they something like an old cemetery of some relatives you never met living in some rural area like that. Did it connect to you? Did you feel something? Did you think?
Yeah, I was always
why it matters.
I was always interested. I was interested in family history, and I knew my grandparents, at least my dad's parents, and heard some of their stories, and so it was kind of cool to see the place.
What do you remember about it most, besides all the one tree every once in a while in a house?
Well, the towns were really small and really far apart.
So now, fast forward, we're in the 20-teens. When did you get involved yourself as an adult? You got very interested in family history. That's one thing we all know about you and inspires us about how you've traced so far back your family all over the world and made connections. When did you get involved with the Cemetery Association in North Dakota while you're living in New Haven?
Yeah, well, I think my dad and my uncle and one of my brothers were involved. And then somehow, like maybe 20 years ago or 25 years ago, they wanted to put up a website. And I helped do that. Okay. I mean, I can write in, the language is called Pidgin HTML.
That's P-I-D-G-I-N?
That's it. Okay. You know, so we put up a simple website.
Does it still exist?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's it called?
It's ashleyjewishcemetery.org.
So you put up a website, and what came of that?
Well, then I've developed a little bit of a relationship with some of the other people involved.
From around the country, like Rebecca, the teacher.
Yeah.
And so at what point did it come about when you said, now it's time to fix up the cemetery and we're going to have a rededication? When did that happen and how?
Yeah, they did a restoration of the tombstones of just a few years ago. And this project took more than a year of effort to get listed in the National Registry. I'm not sure where the idea came from.
How many people you work with on this, getting listed, getting the renovations?
Well, it was mostly Rebecca, and she had a few people helping her a little bit. You know,
how much money was raised?
Well, it didn't really cost anything in particular.
Well, the monument was.
Yeah, the monuments were a few $100. There were a few thousand dollars. There were a few family members, descendants who were just thrilled with the idea and chipped in.
So 2017, June, you're back there with your own family, a new generation. You brought a daughter with you. You had your father with you. What did that feel like to come back where you'd gone as a late teen? What was going through your mind when you were there, when they had the music, when they had 80 to 100 people back in this town that hadn't seen Jews since Dr. Cohen's departure?
Yeah, I felt connectedness. And it made me feel in a deep and profound way that I'm part of a larger story. And that's enriching to me in a lot of ways. It's also important. It provides a perspective on their lives. You know, in a certain way, my great grandfather saw himself as a failure. You know, he left everything they knew in Europe, came to America, and tried to fulfill his dream of farming, and the farm failed. He couldn't run a successful farm, and he lived the rest of his life modestly. You know, went to shul every day. They were truly traditionally observant people. I mean, he never took a step outside of the house without his head covered, and went to shul every day, went to synagogue every day.
Even in North Dakota?
Even in North Dakota. Well, there was no shul every day, but
Brandon was back in Philly.
But yeah, but for the holidays they gathered.
So Yehuda Leib saw himself as a failure.
So he was, and by that measure, he was a failure. But from my perspective, what he did, the one thing that he did that made the difference was decide to come to America, brought his family to America. And that opened up extraordinary opportunities, the possibility of survival for our family, and the possibility to live as a continuation of the Jewish people. And if you look at their descendants today, of which they have hundreds of living descendants. I can't even count them, hundreds of them. So many of them are involved in building Jewish community, in building the civic community, doing good things. A tremendous force for good, especially in Minnesota and Wisconsin, but around the world.
Even narrowly thinking of success and failure. So he tried to be a farmer. The farm didn't work. It failed. But I've heard you say that it paved the way, not just with the general concept of survival, but what happened with the next generation? Did they succeed on those terms? Did they become professionals, store owners? Did they settle with families who had ongoing concerns? They were able to support themselves well?
Yeah, generally they did well. The next generation, the generation of my grandfather and grandmother, I think of my grandpa Ed, he tried a lot of businesses. He was a traveling salesman. He opened stores. He had women's garments. He did had a whole series of business, and he went broke a lot of times. It wasn't until the 1940s, maybe, like around World War II era, he's already like 50 years old, where he goes into something, home renovation and then home construction and then development, where he becomes successful in the conventional financial sense. And he was then reasonably successful at that. But he kept trying. He kept trying. It's like there was a time he was out selling. He was selling vacuum cleaners, you know, selling vacuum cleaners. And it was the end of the day, and he had not sold a vacuum cleaner. And the people said, "This is a great vacuum cleaner, but we just don't want to buy it." And he said, "I've been selling all day. Will you buy something for me? Buy my golf clubs." So they bought his golf clubs, and he never played golf again. You know, he was an entrepreneur. He worked hard. They tried and tried and tried until something worked. And the next generation, my father's generation, then already had that basis. They had family businesses that were operating successful. They had the possibility of not worrying about starving. You know, my dad and his generation, they did work really hard, especially in the early years. But by the time you get to my generation, you know, I've had a very easy and privileged life compared to most people.
And we have the privilege of speaking with John J. Tilson, Rabbi John J. Tilson, on WNHH's High Haven Radio Show. We're talking about John J.'s trip back to a cemetery in North Dakota. And Calchiela Medina Knight writes in on Facebook Live, "That's my rabbi," many exclamation points. And I'm so glad she's listening to the show. Shout out to Calchiela. So John J., when you spoke about this after your return, you were in synagogue, and we were reading the story of the Exodus in the Bible, and the Jews making the decision to leave Egypt for a vision of a better life. And you spoke about how this trip to the cemetery and the story of Yehuda Leib, the few who are buried but the others who moved on, made you think of a connection between those two stories, how they saw themselves as failures, but in fact they weren't failures. They had a vision that the next generation realized, that the Jews wandering the desert who left Egypt did not survive to see the promised land, but their children did. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, it kind of came out of a talk that Morris Bell gave the night before and a comment that Robert Forbes made, where he observed that the generation of the Exodus, they were a complete failure. And they got in a lot of trouble, and they never made it to the promised land. You know, after all they went through, they never made it to the promised land. But, you know, but from my perspective, they were absolutely necessary. They were a generation of transition. It was their efforts and their journey that made the rest of the story possible.
So they were successes.
By that measure.
They were our forefathers and foremothers who enabled there to be a Jewish people that survived and thrived all over the world.
By that measure. And the same for, you know, each of us in our own lives. Some of us feel like we're wonderful successes in what we do. I don't know. And some of us, we don't.
Some of us are a little more concerned on that question.
Yeah. But you don't know your role in the bigger picture, in the bigger story. You maybe have tremendous importance. You just might not know about it.
Sometimes you have the vision and you think you failed one day, but you've laid the groundwork for success on another. Like the community you've helped revive and build up in Westville at Congregation Beth El Kesser Israel, where Rabbi John J. Tilson has been the spiritual leader now for 24 years and going strong. And now he's my rabbi, and I'm proud to say that. It makes all our lives richer. Rabbi John J., thank you so much for coming on High Haven again today. I loved hearing again the story of your trip to North Dakota for the rededication of the Betz Yitzchak Ashley Jewish Homesteaders Cemetery. It's a story that resonates with us here in New Haven, Connecticut, and gives us inspiration for moving our lives forward for the generations to come. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book it with us all week long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.